From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Activists in Syria say 10 more people were killed today in an airstrike near a suburb of Aleppo where the Syrian government is accused of dropping barrel bombs containing chlorine yesterday. Opposition officials in the city say at least one person died in that attack yesterday. 70 or more are said to have been injured, including 37 children and 10 women. Those claims could not be verified, but they come as opposition leaders meet in London to unveil plans for a political transition to end the five-year war in Syria. Hadia Al-Alawi is with the BBC. She joins us from London. Hadia, what do we know first about this alleged chlorine attack?
Well, what we know is that it happened in the eastern side of Aleppo. As we know, probably, that there are two sides in Aleppo. So one side is controlled by the government, which is the western side, as opposed to the one on the east, which is controlled by the opposition. Now, this is not the first time that there have been accusations like this. It actually happened in August, and there were investigations done by the UN with the claims that the government has actually dropped chlorine gas on people in Aleppo.
Yeah.
Now, what we've seen is actually was posted online by civil servants who are actually trying to help people in these areas. One of the group is actually called White Helmets, and what they do is actually they try to save people in situations like that.
Actually, there's a move to have them nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize, right? But this comes as we have this meeting in London of this group of opponents of the Assad regime, and they say that they're putting forth this proposed peace plan to have a peaceful transition where he would step down and there would be an election. We understand that this proposal is to ease President Assad's allies, Russia and Iran, that there will be a peaceful transition. But is there any thinking that this will actually happen?
I don't think so, to be honest. I mean, this is not the first time that such a proposal has been put forward to the Syrian government. The problem is that there is one point that they always disagree on, is whether Bashar al-Assad will remain in power or actually give up power to someone else. Now, from the Syrian government's point, they will never give up the power. So what they've said today is that what they're suggesting for Assad to step down is actually ridiculous. That's what they said. Mm-hmm. So that just shows that they're not willing to actually go through that process of a peaceful transition towards a different government, an elected government. What they said is, let's leave this to people. People have elected Bashar al-Assad. But also, to be able to end the five-year conflict, there needs to be some kind of different resolution at this point. From my point of view as a journalist who's been following this for years, I don't think that's going to happen.
Well, what about a less than peaceful transition? Turkish President Erdogan came back from the G20 and suggested that Turkey would be willing to work with the U.S. to take on Raqqa, which is the Syrian capital of ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
What is the sense that ISIS might be taken on the ground by Turkey?
There is a lot of unease about this idea, especially from Russia. Now, Russia today came out and said, we need Turkey to step away from the northern cities in Syria. So we know for sure that Russia is not happy with Turkey actually being involved in that sort of conflict with IS. There's a struggle of power here, as I mentioned. So basically, you have Russia on one side, which wants to be more involved in fighting IS. And you have on the other side, Turkey, which is trying to be a little bit more involved with America in this fight. Anything is possible when it comes to fighting IS in Syria and Iraq. Anything is possible. We saw how things have quickly changed when the U.S. decided to actually take part in this fight and actually helped in Iraq and even in Syria. So it is possible to see Turkey being involved in that. However, it's probably important to mention here that we've seen a softer approach by Turkey recently and also Saudi Arabia, which is one of its allies, towards the Syrian government. So they're trying to kind of open channels of negotiation and channels of just more a bigger conversation with the Syrian government, as opposed to actually having that very sort of hard line kind of, we don't want any kind of negotiations or any kind of talks with the Syrian government. We saw that recently. So it's quite interesting to watch and see how that's going to play out, because it's very possible that things could change. And soon enough, maybe Turkey and the U.S. would both be targeting IS in Raqqa, which is their biggest stronghold in Syria.
Hadia Al-Alawi with the BBC in London. Hadia, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Well, here in this country today in San Diego, Amazon opened its second physical bookstore, a brick and mortar extension of their online inventory, which already accounts for almost half of all new book purchases by some estimates. Amazon already has a store in Seattle where the company is based, and it plans to expand to Portland and Chicago as well. Amazon announced its plans for Chicago last month, prompting 17 indie bookshops to sign an open letter in protest. Joining me now are the owners of two of those independent bookstores, Lynn Mooney of Women and Children First. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Jeremy.
And Becky Anderson is also with us. She is with Anderson's Bookshops in Chicago. Becky, welcome to you.
Thank you so much.
And tell us why you signed this letter bashing Amazon's plans to open a storefront in Chicago. I'll start with you, Becky.
You know what? I think it's probably the history of what Amazon means to most of us as independents. We own our businesses. We live in our neighborhoods. We live in our communities. And our mission is to build lifelong readers and to put those books face-to-face into people's hands. And I think with the advent of Amazon and knowing that we have been paying sales tax for, you know, from the dawn of sales tax remittance and also property taxes, you know, we see this as an unequal playing field when it comes to the selling of books and what we mean to our communities.
And by the way, Amazon is now paying sales taxes in the state of Illinois. But Lynn, what about you? What was the reason that you decided to sign on to this?
Well, I think so many people have been seduced by the convenience and low prices of Amazon and don't realize the societal cost that is attached. The opportunities to connect with others in a meaningful way are so rare now. But we have to put ourselves out there into spaces, and I think independent bookstores are a fabulous example of that, where real conversations take place, real encounters, on a one-to-one human level. And that can't be replicated by an algorithm or a computer program or an app.
Is there anything different about this, though, than if a farmer's market got angry because a Whole Foods was moving into the community?
You know what? I think it is different. You know, it's a lot bigger than what's happening with the internet sales in general is what's happening to retail space around our country. I think that's a real concern because there's billions of dollars going to be lost and have been lost in property taxes that do support communities. So a farmer's market, you know, and a Whole Foods is not really a good comparison to what the internet is doing to our communities and Main Street.
Well, is there anything that you can actually do to stop Amazon from coming in with its brick and mortar store in Chicago?
I personally choose to think of this as a positive moment where we have an opportunity to engage and educate with the customers who we've already been having these conversations with. The allure of the convenience and low prices have dampened the enthusiasm for having some tough conversations. My particular bookstore, Women and Children First, is located in a neighborhood called Andersonville in Chicago. And about a decade ago, an economic study was done in our neighborhood, and it showed definitively that dollars spent in locally owned businesses do indeed circulate and continue to enrich that local community. And that may just sound like, oh, the business owners are getting rich. But no, it's a kind of enrichment that's a genuine grassroots movement so that the residents of the community, their schools, their institutions, as well as perhaps the commercial strip, are all enriched together. And to be honest, it was studies like this that were part of the spark that ignited the localism movement that, well, is now entering its second decade and has really transformed communities all over the country.
And yet there are still a lot of people who are drawn to these big chains that come into town. And I would throw Walmart into that as well. They want things that are cheaper. They want to be able to get everything that they want, you know, in one place. And frankly, they recognize the brand that, you know, you see a big Amazon logo on a store. You recognize that brand perhaps more than you would a local business, and you know what you're getting there. Do you think that there's any way to sort of turn the tide against the way that so many communities are going?
Oh, I think there definitely is. And I think what we do locally and what we do as independents and as citizens of our own communities is that we connect. We connect with not only the customers that come in our stores, we reach out to our community. Our four walls, our brick and mortar walls are not what we're about. We're about reaching out to our schools. We're reaching out to not-for-profits. We are constantly using books that we love and we know our community loves as bridges to build community. But it's showing what we do, and that's the challenge, that we bring authors and voices and artists to our locations. We put hundreds of free author events in schools every year. There's a higher cost to those lower prices. And when they don't spend their dollars in independent businesses that make a difference locally, they're making a mistake because we, you know, that's a chance that we may no longer be there. And that is a huge economic situation that we could be faced with.
Becky Anderson of Anderson's Bookshops in Chicago. We've also been speaking with Lynn Mooney, co-owner of the Chicago bookstore Women and Children First. They have both signed on to a letter criticizing Amazon's plans to open a brick-and-mortar store in Chicago. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Sunday marks 15 years since 9/11, a day that changed Brian Clark's life forever. He was an executive vice president at Euro Brokers working on the 84th floor of Two World Trade Center. He was one of the few people who managed to escape from one of the floors above where the plane hit the building. Along the way, he helped another man, Stanley Pramnath, get out of the building. And Brian Clark joins us now. Welcome.
It's good to be here.
And I'm sure you've been asked this 1,000 times, but tell us what happened to you on that day.
I arrived at my office about 7:15, which is normal time on a beautiful blue sky day. And I was sitting at my desk, and at 8:46, there was a loud boom, boom. And my head jerked up as the light sort of flashed, and my peripheral vision caught something behind me, and 84 floors in the air was flames right against the glass. It dissipated after about 3 seconds, and out in the airspace was singed newspapers and computer sheets and so on, just sort of floating in the air. Very strange. I thought something had happened a couple of floors above me. Maybe a welder had, on a construction site had hit a gas line, something like that. I had also been in the Trade Center in 1993 and had volunteered to be one of our floor's fire safety marshals. And they had provided a flashlight and a whistle and given us some training in the intervening years. They'd done actually a very good job of that, in my opinion. So I grabbed the flashlight, put the whistle around my neck, went out of my office and started moving the people in my quadrant, as I was instructed, to the center core to await further instructions. So people started to move. The brokers on the east side of our tower rushed to the north windows and looked up 9 floors to the 93rd floor of the north tower and saw a ring of fire around that floor. Hmm. So we knew very quickly that something had happened next door, that it wasn't our building, in fact. I walked to those windows and had heard that people had started to jump. I didn't want to see that, so I stayed back from the windows, went back to my office, called my wife in Mahwah. I called my dad in Toronto, told him, turn on the TV. Something's happened next door, but we are okay. I put down the phone, and the strobe lights flashed. The speaker gave a little whoop whoop, and a voice came upon the PA system and said, your attention, please, ladies and gentlemen. Building 2, the South Tower, is secure. If you're in the midst of evacuation, you may use the re-entry doors and the elevators to return to your floor. Repeat, building 2 is secure. And he went through the instruction again.
And this is just minutes before, by the way, the other plane hit your tower, correct?
That is correct. I came out of my office and came nose to nose with a coworker of mine, Bobby Call. And I said, Bobby, what have you heard? He said, well, I was down a few floors and I heard the announcement and I came back up. And he was in the midst of that sentence when boom, boom, this loud double explosion again. And it was really, I didn't know it at the time, but it was our building being hit and then the plane exploding inside. It came in at about the 78th, 79th floor, 6 floors below us. And in that split second of the double explosion, our floor just fell apart. Everything came out of the ceiling, air conditioning ducts and speakers and the works, if you like, fell down. No electricity. The air was filled with white, chalky construction dust. There was no flames, no smoke at that point. And the building swayed. For 10 seconds, I was terrified. And that, fortunately for me, in hindsight, that was the only moment of the day that I was afraid. For 5 seconds, the building swayed toward the west, toward the Hudson River. And whether this really happened or not, I can't say with certainty, but the sensation was, and this will sound like an exaggeration, but I'm telling you what I felt, the building swayed 6 to 8 feet, and then it stopped. Hmm. And then for 5 seconds, it came back to vertical, and with a noticeable sort of hop or jerk as all the steel went into square, it came back to vertical, and I had this feeling wash over me, Brian, you'll be okay. And for the rest of the day, I felt like I was in control of what I was doing.
So how did you get out of the building before it collapsed? Tell us about that.
I led a group of 6 or 8 people into the center core with my flashlight on. And as I was approaching the intersection, you've got to imagine these two hallways crossing, an east-west hallway, a north-south hallway, crossed in the middle of the building. As I approached the intersection, I had a choice to turn right to stairway C, go straight ahead to stairway B, or turn left to stairway A. I was intending to go to stairway C, and I felt this almost push on my left shoulder. It was a very strange feeling, but there was nobody there. But it pushed me to the left, and I started down stairway A. I just sort of went with it. And with these 6 or 8 people following me down the stairs in the darkness with my flashlight on, we only went down 3 floors when a heavy-set woman coming up the stairs stopped us. And she said, no, you can't go down. There's flames and smoke below. We've got to go higher. And she just refused to let anybody past her. And I was distracted in the midst of this conversation by a stranger's voice inside the 81st floor. I grabbed the shoulder of the fellow beside me, a coworker, Ron DeFrancesco, and I said, Ron, we got to get this guy. And I don't think Ron knew what I was talking about, but we were able to push the drywall back and sort of squeeze between the door frame, the door was locked, between the door frame and the wall. We got Sid sideways through that, and I have this clear memory of everybody being on the floor, the landing, if you like, with me, and they all climbed higher, and sadly, they all died that day. Mm. But Ron and I went in on 81, and halfway to the stranger, Ron was overcome with the smoke, and he went back to the stairs. I continued on to this stranger, kind of dug him out of the rubble, and the two of us went back to the stairway, and I guess that was the fateful moment. I shone the light down the stairs. I only saw smoke billowing up, not any flames, and we just started down. We dug our way through a lot of rubble and got out of the building at about 4 minutes to 10.
Down 80 floors of stairs at that point.
Correct.
Wow.
We ran south from the Trade Center, got to Trinity Church when my new best friend Stanley from Fuji Bank turned around and said, I think that building's going to come down. I said, I don't think so. That's a steel structure. That's carpets and furniture and drapery burning. And I didn't really finish that sentence when boom, 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 from the top, this whole building dissolved in 8 to 10 seconds. Mm. And we watched the South Tower collapse. Trinity Church acted as protection at that time because the white wave of guck slammed into Trinity Church like a wave hitting a seawall, and it exploded upward, and Stanley and I are standing in this big bubble of fresh air. We ran up to Broadway, and when the wave caught up to us, we dove into 42 Broadway, a building I'd never been in before, and we talked for 45 minutes. During that time, the North Tower collapsed. We didn't know that. We went out the back side of 42 Broadway onto Broad Street by the New York Stock Exchange, and somehow we got separated. But I wandered over to the East River. As I started walking north, I heard a bullhorn, next ferries for Jersey City. Well, I want to get to New Jersey. I ran down that pier, jumped on a ferry, and it went down the East River and around Battery Park and wow, northwest toward Jersey City.
So, first of all, do you still keep in touch with Stanley?
Stanley and I are good friends. I went to his oldest daughter's wedding about a month ago. He, several years ago, came to one of my daughter's weddings. One of us calls the other one every couple of months, and we're blood brothers at this point.
Yeah.
And it's an amazing relationship.
And 15 years later, how important is that experience in your life?
Well, I do have lots of friends. I have a pretty wide social circle, and Stanley's part of that. But I guess as I reflect back on the events of that day, what I've realized over time is that there's no point in dwelling on unanswerable questions. You know, what if I'd turned to the right to stairway C instead of going left, going with the push to stairway A? So I have learned, and I tell other people, that there is no point in wasting time trying to answer unanswerable questions. And I have just been gifted with the fact that I don't have survivor guilt. I fall asleep immediately. I haven't had any nightmares about that event, and I take no credit for that. It's just the way it's unfolded for me. Likewise, one cannot predict the future with any certainty. I went to work that day, a normal day, had no idea what was about to happen. And so if you don't dwell on unanswerable questions in the past, you don't worry about the future, it pretty well leaves you with the present. And that's where I try to live every day. Every day is a great day. Some are just greater than others. Life is precious. You know, use every day to your best.
What are you going to do on September 11th this year?
I will be thinking of the people that I worked with, and we lost. We lost 61 people of our 250 employees that day. Our church has a special service that evening at about 5 p.m. And at 7 p.m., I'm going to be in another municipality, a local town, Allendale, where they've asked me to be the guest speaker at their event. It's an annual municipal event. You know, there's a lot of kids that are, well, as old as 20, I suppose, who really have no memory of that day, that apparently will be at the event. I'm speaking at a high school, not that day, but a few days later, and the beat goes on.
Well, Brian Clark, it is probably very nice for people to hear how joyful and uplifting you are after what happened 15 years ago to you. So thank you so much for joining us.
I enjoyed it myself. Thank you very much.
And if you're the boss, or maybe the second manager in charge of managers 3, 4, and 5, you might not want to hear this next story, because researchers writing in Harvard Business Review say there are too many of you, that managers now make up nearly 20% of the workforce, that their excess bureaucracy is costing the economy $3 trillion annually, and that they could be put to other more productive work. Kurt Nikisch is senior editor at the Harvard Business Review. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Kurt.
Hey, Robin.
So nearly 24 million managers, one for every 4.7 workers. This hasn't always been the case. So what's going on? Is this people being Peter principled up, or something else? And why is it so wasteful?
Yeah, so companies essentially have gotten a lot bigger. Part of that is just the fact that globalization has come along. There's a lot more to do. You used to be okay with just the CEO and a COO, and now you have a chief strategy officer and a chief compliance officer, and they have all sorts of people under them. So part of it is just companies have gotten bigger, and there's been this transition to a knowledge economy, less manual labor. There is more to manage, but the authors are saying, look, there's just too much management still. They've been really good at cutting factories, cutting workers, not very good at cutting down layers of management.
Well, like you say, there's so much, like there's the internet. I mean, so much digital, things that have to be managed. But the researchers, Gary Hamel and Michelle Zanini, point to examples of big companies that have a lower proportion of managers and better output. Talk about that.
Yeah. So, and these are serious researchers. Gary's at London Business School. They point to companies, not the hugest companies, but companies like a commercial bank in Sweden that has been able to get by with just 3 layers of management. And it's done so by kind of changing how it operates. Instead of having everything come down from a bank headquarters where they figure out the interest rate for all the different branches to follow, they just leave it up to each branch to decide what interest rate to charge. And so by doing that, they've decentralized a lot of management, and that's cut down on their costs, and they outperform other commercial banks.
Well, but so what are researchers – well, first of all, I should say that there's been some criticism of their findings. And as you well know, there are people writing in the comments section, well, these – you can't just pick a few companies that have done this and say they've done well. You've got to do deeper science on what happens when management is cut.
I think they've studied management for a long time, and they see that companies are trying to figure out how to cut down on these layers because mm-hmm. they're spending more and more money on management. There is more to manage, but do they have to spend all that money on it? But it's risky for companies to try this. Zappos, for instance, is a company that's gone to self-management. They've actually toppled the hierarchy, and they're trying to let workers figure out what needs to be done and figure out how to do it. But that's risky because if you don't figure it out, you lose.
Correctly, right.
But the companies that figure it out are going to be able to leave their competitors in the dust. So you're going to be seeing more and more of this as we go on.
Well, I'll say, I mean, you know, one of the findings, you know, if they cut out just all that internal management, you know, the stuff that you, the papers, the forms you have to fill out,
right.
it wastes 8.9 million worker years by doing that.
Yeah, but just real quick, in the U.S.
Right, in the U.S. But yeah. Kirk, real quick, it's managers who would have to fire these managers.
Yeah, it is managers who would have to fire these managers.
Or themselves.
But a lot of them realize that all the budgeting and performance reviews and security compliance and all that internal stuff they have to do isn't the most productive, most satisfying work. They would like to see that work get better, too.
And they researchers would like to see some of those managers doing some of the more productive work. Kurt Nikisch, senior editor at Harvard Business Review, will post the article at hereandnow.org. Thanks as always.
Yeah.
Funeral services were held over the weekend for Islam Karimov, the president of Uzbekistan. Karimov ruled the Central Asian nation with an iron hand for nearly three decades. And because of its strategic and economic importance, there are big questions now about what comes next in Uzbekistan. Joining us from London is Hamid Ismailov, an Uzbek novelist and editor of the BBC Central Asian Service. Welcome. And you know firsthand the power of this man. You had to flee your home in Tashkent because the government was threatening to arrest you in the 90s. What happened?
Apparently, it was not so much political. It was more sort of, you know, my work as a writer. All writing, all honest writing is subversive by definition because you are showing the reality as it is, you know. So you are breaking lots of lies, propaganda, and so on and so forth. Therefore, I think they were not very happy with me.
So your work is now banned in Uzbekistan?
Yes, it was for the last 25 years, and I hope that hopefully they will allow me to be published in Uzbekistan. Though I must say, with the internet, you know, these restrictions are symbolical because I can publish my work on the net and people can reach. I've got lots of feedback from Uzbekistan. People are reading my work, so it's more symbolical rather than actual.
So we've heard about Islam Karimov as one of the most brutal dictators in the world. Give us a sense of what life is and was like in Uzbekistan under him.
He was a man of great convictions, you know. He was, even his opposition is sort of, you know, recognizing his convictions. But the problem was that these convictions were wrong ones, you know. So he was very authoritarian, even dictatorial, to the extent that it turned even towards his own daughter. He put his own daughter under the house arrest. So you can imagine what he did to others if he was able to put his own daughter under the house arrest. So he was very dictatorial in every aspect of his life, you know, in his relationship with his family, in his politics, in his relationship with the neighboring countries, in his relationship with his own people as well.
And what did his own people think of him?
Very interesting. Apparently, because they lived so long with him for 25 years, there is a shock and mass hysteria now in Uzbekistan. You know, there is a great void now, even among the members of opposition. I've spoken recently to one of the journalists. You know, he was telling me, we were fighting, he says, a great evil. Now the sort of, you know, people who are coming instead of him are petty criminals, you know. So we are losing the sort of aim, he is saying. So in that sense, you know, you can imagine those people who were brought up under him. They didn't know anyone else because he was the symbol of Uzbekistan. Islam Karimov was Uzbekistan, and Uzbekistan was Islam Karimov for the last 25 years. He was the only person who took any decision, you know, in regards of Uzbekistan. Therefore, there is a huge void now, psychological, political, whatever, metaphysical void in Uzbek psyche.
And now there are big questions about what will happen next. First of all, do you have any insight about who is going to be the next leader of Uzbekistan?
So we are reading between the lines, you know. First, initially, according to the constitution, when president is unable or dead, the power should shift immediately to the Senate, i.e. to the chairman of the Senate, who is Mr. Yuldashev. But unfortunately, from the very beginning, it didn't pass on to him. And then the commission, the mourning commission, the funeral commission has been created under the prime minister. And prime minister, little by little, appearing in all functions. For example, Mr. Putin, president of Russia, came to to pay tribute to the grave of Mr. Karimov. He went to Samarkand, coming back from G20. And who was the person to meet him? It was Prime Minister Mirziyayev. Hmm. So little by little, we are seeing that the scene is taken by Prime Minister. Though, as I'm saying, by constitution, it should be the chair of the Senate, and then in 3 months' time, he should call the presidential elections. So far, we are living in a legal limbo.
Do you think that after this legal limbo, Uzbekistan could end up with an Islamist government?
It's not very probable, you know, because the system which has been created by Mr. Karimov is very strong and based on the strength of the security services first and foremost. So security services are deciding who is going to be the next president. So security services are extremely strong in Uzbekistan. Together with, with police and with the army, they can cope with the Islamic threat.
And do you expect that the next leader of Uzbekistan is going to be someone who is closer with Russia and with Putin than with the West?
It depends on the personality, but in any case, we are seeing that the contenders are weaker as personalities than President Karimov. President Karimov, with all his, as I am saying, wrong convictions, was the strong man who developed, in a way, independent Uzbekistan and independence of Uzbekistan. He was trying to go for the West when it was convenient for him. He tried to go for Russia when it was convenient for him. So he had a line. The next person contention, all of them, unfortunately, they are much weaker than him. Secondly, many of them, they are pro-Russians, you know, and Russia will be playing a big part in appointing the next president. So, unfortunately, West is a bit not proactive there. It's not even active there. It's a forgotten part of the world now for the West. China could partly play a role, but I think the main and most important player is still Russia.
And what about the United States? We know that Uzbekistan let the U.S. use its air bases to support the war in Afghanistan, which could have caused the U.S. to turn a blind eye to some of what Karimov had been doing. But how do you see the relationship between Uzbekistan and the U.S. progressing?
Generally, people agree, the experts agree that now U.S. is turning blind eye to the whole region, even to Afghanistan, which was the cause of the rapprochement between Uzbekistan and the United States. In that sense, you know, because Afghanistan is a forgotten place, so Uzbekistan is more of a forgotten place. Central Asia is more of a forgotten place. Unfortunately, United States, it's not active there at all.
And Hamid, what about the economic consequences of this? Uzbekistan is a major energy player around the globe.
Uzbekistan is a very rich and strategically very important place. For example, Uzbekistan is one of the biggest exporters of the cotton, for example. Uzbekistan is one of the biggest gold producers in the world. Uzbekistan is full of gas, for example, which goes now not just to Europe, but mostly to China.
Right.
Uzbekistan is one of the biggest producers of uranium, for example. So Uzbekistan is placed centrally in a very important region. On one side, because you've got China. On the other side, you've got Iran, Afghanistan, and the Muslim world. On the third side, you've got Russia, and so on and so forth. It's strategically very important place. But unfortunately, the West is not seeing Uzbekistan as a sort of strategic place and strategic partner.
And do you think that whatever happens next, there's a chance that you might go back to Uzbekistan?
I came to the West for 3 months just saving my life because there was a threat of the imminent arrest, you know. And these 3 months now are lasting 24 years. So I never planned to come here for a long time. So therefore, I'm not immediately planning to go to Uzbekistan now, but I can't sort of say that in a year time I won't be there.
That's Uzbek novelist and editor of the BBC Central Asian Service, Hamid Ismailov, talking with us about Uzbekistan, where the leader, the longtime leader, Islam Karimov, has died. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
We're approaching the 15th anniversary of 9/11, a day which, as we've been hearing this week, will mean many things. But among them, this Sunday will be the first time in 15 years that car 745, one of the two subway cars that survived the collapse of the World Trade Centers on 9/11, will welcome visitors aboard at its new permanent home in East Haven, Connecticut. As Laurie Mack of Here and Now contributor WNPR reports, the Shoreline Trolley Museum acquired the car a year ago and built a special display to be dedicated on this Sunday's anniversary.
On a normal weekday in New York City, people by the thousands arrive at the Port Authority Trans-Hudson or PATH World Trade Center station. For PATH Car 745, September 11, 2001 started like any Tuesday morning, loaded with passengers from New Jersey. At 8:52, it pulled into the station for the last time. Within 3 hours, it would be buried beneath hundreds and thousands of tons of debris. Alan Zalazzo knew Car 745's route well.
Newark to the World Trade Center. That was my regular route up till that day.
He was a PATH train engineer scheduled to go into work later that day, so was not on duty that morning, but knew the stops by heart.
It left at 8:42 out of Hoboken in the morning. When it left Pavonia Newport is when the buildings got hit. So midway in this train's trip, it left in peacetime, ended up in a war zone.
After the planes hit, before the buildings came down, and before anyone understood what was happening, the Port Authority suspended all train service into New York. In fact, another PATH train from New Jersey was en route, but the crew was instructed to turn around when they reached the World Trade Center station and take all passengers back.
So rather than have an additional 2,000 people dropped off in a potential deadly area, they got them back out of there.
Bill Wall works for the New York City Transit Authority. He remembers that day as he sits surrounded by vintage trolley cars at the Shoreline Trolley Museum in Connecticut. He says the Port Authority saved thousands of lives with that judgment call.
At that point, everybody was getting out, and they sent the train with the crew into the Trade Center to what we call sweep the platform. Anybody who's there, they had one last chance to get out. And shortly after that, the buildings came down.
As a result, there was no loss of life on the PATH trains or in the World Trade Center station that day. But an empty seven-car train that included Subway Car 745 was left behind.
It was a train that was in the terminal that they just finished using, and normally we'd leave it there during the day to wait for the afternoon rush hour to start. It was already in place, and that's the reason that train was there.
The train was discovered during a search of the site. Five of the cars were obliterated, a sixth car suffered minor damage, and a seventh was undamaged. That was the lead car, Car 745. The surviving two PATH cars were taken to Kennedy International Airport, where they were stored in a hangar with other artifacts held for use in a future 9/11 memorial museum. That, says Wall, is where they stayed for nearly 14 years, but did not make it into the museum.
The decision was made to not include the two PATH cars. They were just too big. They were 50 feet long and, you know, weigh 40 tons.
New homes were found for both cars. One went to the Trolley Museum of New York in Kingston, and car 745 came here to the Trolley Museum in Connecticut, where Zelazo and Wall donate much of their time. Wall is president emeritus of the museum, and Zelazo has been volunteering here since he was 16. He works on the cars and helps with other projects. He says he hasn't done much work on 745, but he has been all through the car and found some surprises.
Behind the ad where the conductor would stand in the rear of the car, there was a crossword puzzle, part of the newspaper stuffed back there from the day before. And you see stuff like that, you know, it just makes you go, wow.
While car 745 managed to get through basically unscathed structurally, Wall says there was some damage to the car.
I mean, the only problems that it had didn't happen from the event, but right afterwards, the car was flooded to just about up to floor level with water from trying to put the fires out, you know, and water mains that had broken and everything else.
The aluminum 1972 Class PA3 car now shines like new. That's mostly thanks to another volunteer. Conrad Mizik is a native of Queens, New York. Mizik is modest about the several hundred hours of work he's put into car 745.
There had been some damage done craning it out of the World Trade Center site. I fixed some body damage, reglazed it, did some wiring, things of that nature.
Mizik has invested some of his own money into the project, which includes low-voltage lighting that lights up the car and the side signs and replaced the advertisements that were originally in the car on 9/11. Aboard car 745, Mizik points out an ad featuring the World Trade Center.
This is my favorite over here. I don't think you're going to get that picture anymore. That is a scene taken from Jersey City of the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center and the World Financial Center.
And it says
discount hotel rates, hoteldiscount.com. I think that's a little bit before Airbnb.
Bill Wall was instrumental in acquiring the car. He says in a day of terrible tragedies, car 745 is a survivor.
Prior to that event, it was just an everyday run-of-the-mill subway car. Now it's an icon. And it's exactly what it is.
A dedication and ceremony are scheduled to take place at the Shoreline Trolley Museum in East Haven, Connecticut, at noon Sunday, September 11th. For Here and Now, I'm Laurie Mack.
One of many events that day. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.